Okay, I think we can start. Boker Tov, everybody. Welcome to class 26 of our Torah in Motion series on the Siddur. And yes, we're still in Birchat HaShachar in Korbanot. We'll see what we can get through. But I am always interested in your feedback and comments and stuff. Some people tell me they like the slow pace. Some people don't. Whatever. Everybody likes their own things. Hopefully you gain something from the shiurim and you find it meaningful. But I am always interested in the constructive criticism or even non-constructive criticism. And compliments don't hurt either. But okay. All right. Okay. Thank you very much. So we just last week introduced Eizo Mekomot, I believe. And I pointed out that this the common thread. Why do we say Eizo Mekomot? So we says we have to learn part of the Siddur. Part of the Siddur is for people who they're very busy at work. They don't have time to learn. There's a mitzvah of Talmud Torah every day, and the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, as we have discussed, is a three-pronged mitzvah. You have to learn a little bit of Tanakh. You have to learn a little bit of Mishnah, and you have to learn a little bit of the Gemara. Mishnah and Gemara don't mean the text of Mishnah and Gemara we have today, because this was said before there was such a text of Gemara. It means Mishnah means the straight halachas. This is what you do, this is what you don't do. That is the way our Mishnah is written. Gemara's analysis, Gemara's understanding and the application and stuff. So again, a lot of our Gemara is like that, but you have a lot of Mishnah in the Gemara, you know, where the Gemara just says halacha. So that's the three prong, and we've been discussing. So we did the Korban Tami, the verses in the Torah about the daily sacrifices. Now we're doing the Mishnah, Eizo Mekomot, and then we're going to do Rabbi Yishmael Omer, the analysis, the 13 ways we read Torah between the lines. That's what really Rabbi Yishmael is. How do you read Torah between the lines and derive all the laws of the Torah? Because 99% of the laws of the Torah are not written in the Torah. There's 613 laws in the Torah that the Rambam explains that's written black and white. That's if it says a verse in the Torah, honor your parents. So that's a mitzvah. But the 39 milachot of Shabbat, the 39 categories, 99% of the Torah is not written in the Torah. It's interpretation. It's reading between the lines. So that has the status of a biblical law, but it doesn't have the status of one of the 613 mitzvot. So that hopefully we'll get there in a couple weeks. And we said, why do we pick on Rabbi Yishmael Omer? I mean, why do we pick an Eizo Mekomot? So of course it's on Korbanot, and Tefillah is connected to Korbanot. Our Tefillah parallels the idea of Korbanot. We mentioned this sometimes opposes the idea of Korbanot. Korbanot are rigid, as we spoke a little bit last night, rigid and fixed, and you can't deviate. And Tefillah is spontaneous. It's from the heart. It can change. It should change. The Gemara says, "Set Tefillah tokeva." If you make your prayer permanent, ain't Tefillah to tachnunin, then it's not mercy. It's actually a very powerful statement. You're not allowed to pray the same thing every day. That's what we do. I don't know exactly. We're not supposed to really. Set Tefillah tokeva. Keva may, you can perhaps have not keva, even with the same word. The tefillah can't be the same. You can't say, 11 and a half minutes to Barchu. I know lots of shuls like that. They have so. I was once in a shul in a shtibel, a very Haredi shtibel, I remember in New York, and there was a sign. You start minyan at 7, you get to Barchu at 7:14, you get to Kriyat, Shmon Esri at, 7:18, Chazar to Shetz at 7:22. We're like, oh my gosh. So that's Oset Tefillah, as I understand it, Oset Tefillah to Keva. The Korbanot are Keva, are permanent, are fixed, unchanging. Tefillah is changing, it's supposed to be. We've discussed this, of course, why in theory the Siddur is a bad thing. In theory, everybody should pray what they want, but it doesn't work functionally. Functionally, that's impossible. So we have to, we had to create a Siddur, but as we said, the Shmon Esri was insisted that it be said quietly so people can add in their own things. Don't just say the 19 blessings of the Shmon Esri. Add in your own personal request and all kinds of other things. So that's so Tefillah connected Korbanot. Tefillah is sometimes opposed, is opposite of Korbanot. But anyways, Tefillah and Korbanot go hand in hand, and therefore we picked Eizo Mekomot. And then we mentioned, we ended off last week by saying that there's no machloket, there's no argument. And so this is a very beautiful thing. We have a Mishnah that has no arguments in it, a whole chapter Mishnah. So I've heard many people say this is the only chapter of the 525 chapters of the Mishnah where there's no argument. That's pretty, 524 have arguments, 51 doesn't. So that's not exactly true. As I mentioned last week, it's not true at all. As a matter of fact, in Masechet Tamid, which talks on the Korban Tamid, it's not just the Korban Tamid. the daily functioning of the temple. It begins with the guards around the temple, the Levim, the daily functioning. So five of the seven chapters have no machloket. And just one of them, if it's not even so much a machloket, there's too little difference of opinions. So it's not only this chapter that doesn't have machloket, but the one that talks about the daily ritual in the temple doesn't. I think, I don't know if I mentioned, but if I did, let's review. If not, it's new. It would make a lot of sense that in the temple there wouldn't be any machloka. We discussed already Kohanim's Rizimim. The Kohanim are meticulous. That's why rabbinic prohibitions are allowed in the temple, because rabbinic prohibitions are to guard, to protect you. You're careless, you're lazy, you forget. You don't have to worry. In the temple, everybody's, you know, on edge. Everybody's watching very carefully. So you have, obviously, the I think I mentioned that the Kohanim kept their status very strongly. So there was, it would make a lot of sense that the people in charge of the temple were very careful and very meticulous. So no debate ever happened. The Gemara says, we discussed this in our Pirkei Avot here a couple of years ago, we really have two diametrically, we have a machloket about a machloket. We have a dispute, are disputes good or not, right? The Gemara, and by one place, the Gemara says, by Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai argued for 3 years. And who was right? I'm right. Every, you know, you're both right. How can you both be right? You're right too, right? So the, and then the Talmud says, a heavenly voice came out and said, they're both right. Yeah, they are both right. Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim. They're both the words of the living God. The Torah is gray. And depending on your perspective, some see gray a little bit more white and some see gray a little bit more black. So from the same gray, you can have two different perspectives and they both can be correct. We have two different interpretations of Shakespeare. I can say the opposite things. And they both be correct. Two many interpretations that even if they're opposite. So that's one view. Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim im chayim. They're both the words of the living God. And then we have another view, also Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. So it's not like different people. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says, originally there were no debates. Originally, when there was a dispute, people went to the temple. They went to the Beit Din, and the Beit Din, you know, answer what they had to do. And if they didn't know, they went to the Sanhedrin. When then Misha Meitu Hillel and Shammai, so when after Hillel and Shammai died, and their students lo shimshu kol tzorcham. Their students were not so meticulous. Lo shimshu, they didn't serve their teachers so well. You know, they were passing notes. They were browsing the internet during the shiur. You know, they weren't totally listening, and they passed a note, and they turned around, and they looked at their friend in the hall, and they checked their WhatsApp. You know, so they missed a little bit this year. So me that they're Rabu Machloket. They had a lot of arguments because they weren't totally focused. That's what the Gemara in Sanhedrin says. And Naset Torah Kishtei Torah. The Torah was in danger of being split into two. So we discussed, can these two Gemaras be reconciled or not? Do these represent two opposing views on Machloket? Or do you say it depends on the type of Machloket? And I would say both of those are true. In other words, sometimes yes, sometimes no. But anyway, Machloket in many ways is considered very negative. It's sort of the bread and butter of the Talmud, and they're sometimes positive things. And yes, because some things really are gray, and really, you really do want to see two perspectives. And sometimes machloket is laziness and carelessness and not being careful. And it's not always easy to determine which is which, but there is something nice when there's no machloket. Yeah. Now, so in the temple, there's going to be no machloket because the Kohanim were very careful. Of course, what's very sad is that doesn't last. The temple becomes the focal point of machloket. It's interesting if you look, especially not only, but especially in the Masechet Sukkah. So the Gemara describes some of the terrible things. That's really Sukkah and Yuma Yom Kippur, where you know, laws of Yom Kippur. The Tzdukim, you know, the Sadducees are not, I mean, the Gemara doesn't call, the Mishnah doesn't say that they were Sadducees, but we know that many of the people running the temple during the later years of the Second Temple period were Sadducees, or there were people who did not follow the rabbinic teaching, and there was tremendous debates. And, you know, the Mishnah in Sukkah has a wild like case when they did the water libations, right? The Nisuach HaMayim, you have to pour water on the altar. Sukkot is the time we pray for rain. We should really pray for rain the first day of Sukkot, but we don't want it to rain on Sukkot. So we wait till Shmini Atzeret. But Sukkot is the beginning of the rainy season in Israel, so that we pour water libations on the temple every day. It's the only time of the year we do that. But that's not mentioned anywhere in the Torah. You can't find it in the Torah. So the rabbis either halacha l'moshe m'sinai, either they had an oral tradition with absolutely no basis, or the Gemara says there's an extra letter here, an extra letter there, whatever it is. You can read the whole Torah 89 times, 8,900 times, and have no idea that you pour water. So the many rabbis, the Kohenim, get out of here pouring water. You reformers, when it doesn't say in the Torah you pour water, we're not going to pour water. So it says one time the Kohen was there. So, and I guess the rabbis were in charge, but not all the Kohanim were so, and they bought their positions and they got like now a lot of our leadership, but they're not so ayayay. They get there with money and corruption and all kinds of nice, fine ways. So the Kohen took the water, but he tried to trick everybody. So instead of pouring it on the altar, he poured it on his feet and he would hope nobody noticed. And they noticed. And of course, what happened next? The Mishnah says, Ragmuhu kola am betrogim. Everybody took their etrog and they stoned him with the etrogim. It's like, it's so wild. And the Mishnah there has other things, the people themselves, and they damaged the Mizbech, 1,000 people throwing etrogim at the guy. It doesn't say if he lived or died. I don't know what happened, but anyways, and the Gemara there in Sukkah has other examples that everybody used to take the lulav to the Beit HaMikdash, and then on Shabbos, you'd bring it before Shabbos, but everybody wanted their own lulav, and they were fighting, and they were killing each other, like they were stabbing each other with the lulavim and etrogim. We learned already, the guy threw off on the altar because he wanted to do the Trumat Hadesh, and we discussed that a few weeks ago. People get very uptight, religious fanaticism is that's the worst, when people fighting for religion. So the temple, sadly, even though in theory it shouldn't be a place of machloket, became a case of machloket. And the first machloket in Jewish history, as far as we know, the first recorded machloket in the Mishnah, right? There, I said, okay, 518 of the chapters have machloket. But historically, it's easy to trace. It is not hard to figure out. It's very obvious. This is the first historical machloket. Anybody want to guess what the first historical debate was? In Jewish history, the first machloket that we know of in rabbinic literature.
Take a guess.
To write down
the oral law or not?
No. So first of all, that came later. That only comes in the year 220. That comes like 700 years later. There's that. In other words, I'm talking. It's the beginning of the Second Temple period. It's not right at the beginning, but it's early. Way before the Mishnah is written, hundreds of years before the Mishnah. So this is recorded in the Mishnah in Chagiga. Masechet Chagiga talks about the Chag, the Korban Chagiga, the festival offering that you had to bring three times a year when you went to the temple to have a nice meal. So you brought meat, right? That's the Korbanot, to have a nice, you didn't just eat it yourself. You brought to the altar. That's the Korban Chagiga. So there's a whole tractate. Well, it's not so big. Three chapters of the Mishnah in Chagiga. So they mention a five-generation machloket. For five generations, this argument went on. The five generations of the Zugot. When you learn Pirkei Avot, so it's Moshe Kibbutz Torah Misinai, Masar Yeshua, Yeshua Levim, the Skein Levim, Anshei Knesset Agdola. After the Anshei Knesset Agdola, you have Shimon HaTzadik and Antignosh Isocho. And then you have, who do we have? Yossi Ben Yoezer and Yossi Ben Yochanan. And then you have Nitai Arbali and Shimon ben Shetach. Maybe Shimon Shetach is the third one. Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shetach. We have five, Shmai and Avtalion and Hillel and Shammai. You have five generations. Five generations. That's the generations that we call in the rabbinic literature zugot, the five generations of pairs, where one was the Av Beit Din and one was the Dinasi. One was sort of the president, the overall arching leader, and one was the chief justice of the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court, the Av Beit Din. That's Hillel and Shammai. So, and then we move to the period of the Tanaim. Hillel and Shammai are the transition period from what we call the pairs, the zugot, to the time period of the Mishnah. So for these five generations, there was an argument whether you do smicha on yontif. When you bring a korban, you bring your korban ola, you bring the shalmei mechage, you bring, you people were allowed, obligated to bring korbanot on Yontif. So the question is, whenever you brought a korban, you did smicha, right? What smicha means, you lean, right? What we call, when rabbis get smicha, what does that mean? It means Moshe put his hands on Yoshua and he leaned on him. It's a symbolic transferring of authority from one to the other. That's what smicha is. It's nothing to do with rabbi. It's just, we use the term, he got smicha. Now, we don't even do that today. When I got smicha, nobody put their hands on me, nobody gave me authority, because we don't have smicha anymore. The smicha we had, God lost. I'm assuming, I don't know. I assume when they have the real smicha, they'll really do smicha. They'll do, but there's also halacha to do smicha, to lean on a korban, because again, we're symbolizing that the korban is us. We want to sacrifice, especially the Ramban notes on a sin offering. So we deserve to, you know, be hurt, you know, whatever. We deserve to go on the altar, but God is very nice. He's not going to kill us. Nobody would be around every, you know, because but in a sense, we're giving part of our flesh, part of our blood is to go on, and we don't do that. We're nice, so we transfer from us, we put smicha, we put our hands on the animal. So there was a debate, are you allowed to do smicha on Yontif? And that debate lasted for five generations. So that was the first debate in Jewish history, as far as we know, in rabbinic literature, because Yossi ben Yochanan are mentioned so rarely in the Mishnah, almost never. They're mentioned in Sota and here, and that's about it in Pirkei Avot, because rabbinic literature doesn't really begin to develop till later on. But you already had earlier this debate about whether you do smicha in the temple. I remember many years ago, Rabbi Rakefet told us that, why did this become the first debate? So he felt this was already the beginning of the period when rabbinic authority in the temple was lost, when the temple was no longer in the full control of the rabbis, and people stopped coming. A lot of the religious people stopped going to the temple. So who wants to go there? It's corrupt, you know, too much talking in shul. I don't want to go. I want to stay home. So people stopped going to the temple. A lot of the, I don't know if it's true. It's an interesting thing. And therefore, obviously, when the scholars aren't there and the many people aren't there, it's easy to have debate come in. Okay. Anyways, that's some of the background to debate and the temple and the relationship. The temple is supposed to be a place of peace where there isn't debate, where we come for shalom and unity, etc. Okay, let us quickly, or we'll see, Zev, I hope I'll meet your quick requirements, how quickly we can go through the chapter Ezim Koman. So in there, you can take the Mishnah in Zvachim if you'd like. It's printed in every Siddur, in my Koran Siddur that I have in front of me, page 51. But Ezim Koman Shel Zvachim. Where is the place that we slaughter the sacrifices? So like I said, everything in the temple, as we'll see in this chapter, is so regimented. It got to be exactly as we, not the Venevil, you know, they made a little slip up. We don't even know what they did and they got killed. The temple, you're playing with fire. You know, it's like you're in the hydro, you're in the most powerful place in the world. So we're in a very powerful place. If you misuse the power, you're in big trouble. So Ezim Koman Shel Zvachim. So Kosher Kosher Mishkan Tamid Safon. So it's very, so the Holy of Holies, we divide Korbanot into Kodesh Kodeshim and Kodeshim Kalim, into Holy Holies and Kodesh Kodeshim and Kodesh Kalim, lighter holies. The Kodesh Kodeshim can only be eaten in the temple. Kodesh Kalim can be eaten in Jerusalem. Kodesh Kodeshim can only be eaten by the Kohanim. Kodesh Kalim can be eaten by non-Kohanim. So you have distinctions between how the Korbanot are brought, which is what this parak is going to go through. So it says the Kodesh Kodeshim. What are the Kodesh Kodeshim? Which of the sacrifices are the Holy of Holies? So that's the Ola, the Chatat, and the Asham. The Korban Ola, the burnt offering, I don't like that term, right? We discussed that's where everything goes on the Mizbeach. That is voluntary, except most of the Korban Ola were voluntary. You wanted to say thank you or whatever, you're bringing a Korban Ola. We will have, of course, the Korbanot on the Yamim Tovim and Shabbos and the Korban Tamid. The communal sacrifices, they were all pretty much, all with few exceptions, were all Korbanot Ola. So that's, and a Chatat and a Sham, as we discussed, all right, but I don't know if we discussed it here, but the chatat is for one of the 36 sins that had you violated them on purpose, there would have the punishment of karet, eating chametz on Pesach, eating on Yom Kippur, violating the Shabbat, many of the sexual sins, idolatry, etc. So if you did them by accident, you bring a korban chatatz. There are 36 karet, but only 31 of them have a korban for particular reasons. Five of them don't have a korban, let's say brit milah and korban pesach, which are the only two positive mitzvot that have karet. The only two mitzvot that if you don't do them, you get karet. Usually it's much worse. You do something. Here you didn't do it. Nonetheless, the korban pesach and brit milah, which are so important, the personal and communal covenant with God, there's isur karet, but there's no korban if you don't do it. I mean, the do tshuva is do the mitzvah. That's it. And then and going into the temple when you're impure, it also has a korban ola b'yoreh, doesn't have a echata. No, doesn't matter. I mean, I guess on a certain level it matters, but for us, it's not practical. But one beautiful idea, Zev, you'll forgive me. I'll mention what I mentioned last week in shul. Zev is the gabbai ropana, which is a small little shul where for 9 years I served as the unofficial rabbi. And I was working as an accountant most of those years. I would every Shabbos, they get 50, 60 people. And I spoke every Shabbos and Yontif and, you know, and then I became a real, I don't want to say that. I became a rabbi of a slightly larger shul. And now my son lanes an opana on occasion. And it's a minion, is much smaller. It's a building there. We had exactly 10 people last week in the horrendous weather. So I walked in and Zev asked me to give a Dvar Torah. Because, like in the olden days. Anyway, so I'm going to say now a little bit what I said last week. I hope, Zev, you can go send WhatsApp messages. Okay, so anyways.
Can I ask a quick question?
Oh, I didn't even say anything yet.
Well, what you just said before, you said sure. that if you don't do bris, you have a punishment is chorus. Who gets the punishment, the father or the son?
The son.
But he's a baby.
No, he doesn't get it then. So there's a machlok at the Rambam and the Ravid. When do you get karts? So kart is only the age of 20. That's courts only give punishments to the malkut. All punishments of court only age 20. Like in the Torah, you go to military service, the age of 20. From 13 to 20, it's not true at bar mitzvah, you're fully an adult. Like in Canada, we have the Young Offenders Act. You know, a 16-year-old kid, I said they had on the news this week, some 12-year-old kid was involved in a murder. I don't know if it was a murder. Like the police were like, said how horrible this is. So they stole a car with guns, 12-year-old kids. So we have what's known as the Young Offenders Act. We treat them differently. So in the Torah, you have your obligations at 13, but you don't really get punished till 20. You get 7 years break because Torah understands teenagers. You know, we're not fully mature people, and when we're teenagers, and so there's no court imposed punishment on anything until a person's the age of 20. But the karet, it's true, it's a father's obligation. The Gemara is very clear. If the father doesn't do it, the Beit Din has to do it, or the mother, who somebody has to do it. And if not, the kid's got to arrange it when he gets older. Yeah, it's harder, of course, but it's the kid who gets karet. So the debate is the Rambam and the Ravid, I forget who says which, do you get karet? You turn 20 and every day you get an Isur karet because every day you're having up bring the, oh no, it's only if you die. Without doing brit milah, their karet is at the end of your life. If you ended up dying without brit milah, that's a karet, whatever. So it's on the son. The father has to do it, but the ultimately it's the son who's responsible that it gets done. But
there's no punishment to the father.
I'm sorry?
So there's no punishment to the
father. There's no punishment by a court. There's no human punishment. There's heaven. God, you know, God can do his own things. But there's heavenly punishment, correct. But, I mean, karet anyways is not a human punishment. That's the whole thing's in heaven. But when the Torah prescribes karet, it's prescribing it for the son, not for the father. Anyway, what we said last week is I don't think I said this before here. Let me know if I did. Well, that the Torah is very insistent. That the court, where do you slaughter the korbanot? So you have the chatat, the ola, and the asham. So it's a pasuk in the chumash. Bimkom asher yishchatat, you have to shecht the chatat in the place where you shechted the ola. By the shlamim, it doesn't say that. The Torah is insistent that the korban ola and the chatat and the asham, which are sin offerings, the asham is for sins you did on purpose. We'll get there. Which sins? That has to be slaughtered in the same place as the place of the ola. Why? Everybody except Zev. Maybe I'll ask Zev. I'll see how much he was paying attention. Okay. I'm sorry.
Not to embarrass people.
So the simple answer is not to embarrass people. A beautiful answer, not to embarrass people. We don't want, If you got, here are where all the sinners come to bring their sacrifice. So first of all, half of them won't come. Who would go? And if they do go, it embarrasses them. That's terrible. You're not allowed to embarrass people. That's why, that's another reason the Shmona Esrei is silent. Slach lanu avinu ki chatanu. Like you can, you know, we're ashamnu bagandu. We have a communal one that we sing, as Rav Soloveitchik says, because when we say it, ashamnu, it's a happy tune. You know, why? Because the community demands forgiveness. We don't ask God for forgiveness. We demand it. It's a little bit chutzpah. We can have chutzpah. The Jewish people have the right to be chutzpahdik to God as people. We put up with 4,000 years of pogroms and Holocaust, and we're faithful, and we accepted, no other nation wanted to accept the Torah. We as a community, God, you made a covenant with us. We tell you what to do. I mean, doesn't always work, but that's the Rav develops this theme. It is pretty harif. Like Rav Yevil Yitzchak Bartitcher, we know all the stories. He did it with individuals. The community demands forgiveness. The individual is a nobody. The individual is begging on his knees. Oh my gosh, who am I? A sinner, terrible, awful. You have hunched over, and we say it at the end of Shemona Esrei. We cannot say it in the middle. We don't even dare approach God in the middle of Tefillah, right? If you look in Yom Kippur, Al Chayitz Hashamnu is always at the end, after Hamav Barachat the Moed Shabbat Shalom, in the repetition of the Chazan, it's in the middle, before Motim. Because for the community, it's right in the middle of where we're davening. That's fine. It's just part of what we do. The end, we don't even have the chutzpah as an individual to ask God to forgive us. Like after we finish davening, oh God, you know, I forgot to ask you something. Can you forgive me for all my sins? You know, so we come very meekly at the end. So we don't want to embarrass people. It's got to be very quiet. Got to be very, very quiet. We have that in a lot of places. I mentioned last week, right, when you get married. The chazan, the rabbi, you shouldn't give the boy the ring and say to put the ring on the girl and say, hooray. He'll forget. He's nervous. It can be embarrassing. So, you know, the good rabbis, hooray, hooray, because like, you know, the president of the United States, the Supreme Court justice, say word for word, even though it's a thing, it can be very embarrassing. The Mishnah has it, Bikurim. Right, when the Bikurim, which we'll say at the Pesach Seder, when the farmer brought the first fruits. So the Mishnah says people stopped coming. I don't think they said because they, I don't know if the Mishnah said they stopped coming or they instituted from the beginning that the Kohen had to say it, Arami Oved, Arami, Arami Oved, Oved, Avi, by Yisham, by Yisham. Because if you ask the person, even though it's only six verses, many people knew it up by heart. The guy in front of you knows it by heart. You don't know it by heart. It's very embarrassing. So they insisted you're not allowed to. That's why you hear stories like how the Chafetz Chaim, when he would make Kiddush, would always have a sitter. Because if he had a guest in his house, because the guest would feel bad. Why does the Chafetz Chaim know Kiddush by heart? And I don't know Kiddush by heart. Or I guess they have the same thing that maybe you spill, you know, that old thing you have to spill to make your tablecloth, you know, dirty so the guest doesn't feel bad. I don't know if it's exact. It's the same idea. We go out of our way not to embarrass sinners. The sinner wants to do atonement. That's fantastic. We have to encourage sinners. We have a lot of those halacha, takanat hashavim. We have the famous one in sukkah, right? You steal wood and you build your sukkah. So in theory, you have to take down your sukkah and get back the wood. You have to get back what you stole. But the Gemara says no one's going to do that. That makes it too hard to repent. So I said, I'll pay money instead, even though that's not the halacha. The Torah, you have to get back with. So no. Takanat hashavim, in order to make it easier to do tshuva. So if we're going to, God forbid, embarrass somebody, we can't do it. That's reason one. I like reason two better, though. I think reason two is more. We know that. I mean, we know it, but we don't always do it, not to embarrass people. Reason number two is I think that the korban chatat is the prerequisite for the korban olah. What I mean? In order to become a tzaddik, you must sin. Ain tzaddik ba'aretz asher lo yechted. There's no righteous person who doesn't sin. So I think we generally interpret it like that's a lament, you know, and there's no, who cannot sin? The Gemara says there were four people who didn't sin. Yishai, not great people. It's impossible. Everybody sins. Moshe, everybody, Avram, everybody does that. You can't, a human being. Ain tzaddik ba'aretz asher yaseh tov lo yechted. It's not a lament. It's a good thing. The only way we grow in life is through learning from our mistakes. You have to sin. I mean, I'm not saying go out and eat pork. That's not what I mean. But in order to grow, you have to sin. You have to make mistakes. You can't become great. A leader can't become, no one can become great unless you take risks and you do things and you make mistakes and sometimes terrible mistakes. So Ein Tzaddik Baretz, Asher Yisetov Lo'echta, the Shlomo Melech is telling you, if you want to be a tzaddik, you're going to have to go through a stage of being a ra. Like, it's just what it means. Yes. I don't know, whatever term. So, b'mkom asher yishchatet where they put the olah, that's the chatat. Because if you want to get to God, fully to God, 100% to God, you're going to have to go through a stage of sinning. That's what Rashi quotes, not a similar idea. Asher nasi yachta. When the Torah describes the, there's a special korban as is coming up in the Mishnah, if we ever get there. Asher nasi yachta, that if the nasi, we're talking the sins. So it doesn't say im. It says asher. When then that's, because it's impossible to be a leader and not to sin. That's impossible. You cannot be a leader and not. Then you're a lousy leader, because leaders have to make tough decisions all the time. And if you just avoid decision, that's an even worse sin. So Rashi says, blessed is a generation where the Nasi can admit, like Moshe Rabbeinu, when Aaron criticized him after for Moshe yelling at Elazar ben Itamar, you're right, greatness when the Nasi can say, I sinned. It takes tremendous power for leaders to say it's sin. But everybody, that's why I alluded to before, that's why it's so important that leaders act for the intent of heaven. I mentioned this idea I've mentioned before, and I didn't mention it last Shabbos, right? That that's stressed. Whoever is engaged in communal work, in faith, because communal leaders, by definition, are sinning, I don't want to say all the time, but have to make decisions that hurt people all the time. That's for sure. There's no decision a leader makes that doesn't hurt somebody. You have to. Whether it's getting rid of employees, whether it's budget decisions, all kinds of things that you do, it's impossible to be a leader and not to hurt people. That's life. The leader has to take into account what's the least hurt, what's the most good, but he's never going to get it 100% right. And that's okay. That's okay. As long as your intent is good. Normally, we don't care as much with what you do. We said, but by here, so I by taking decisions that they're not so clear. We sometimes won't know for 10 years or 100 years, something, 100 years if those decisions were right. And you can think of all the world events that's going on, now. What's the right decision? Very hard to know. Very hard to know. Yeah, yes, they do want to be. You do no fly, not no fly. Yeah, how can Israel be in the not the state? How can Jews of all people not get involved to help people who are being massacred? And yeah, on the other hand, how can Israel, they have to worry about what's going on in Syria? I don't have to make those decisions. I don't know what the right, maybe I'm getting already too much involved, but these are tough decisions and they're not easy to make. So, but okay, that's on a communal level, but also on an individual level. And in normal people, forget people. How do you grow? You take a chance to make sin. So I really think that's what the Torah is saying. I think it's even more powerful. Yeah, not embarrassing people. We know it's of course very important, but we have that in a lot of places. But this idea that the Korban Chatat and the Asham, the sin offerings, have to be brought, the only way to get to the Olah, you have to bring it in the same place because it comes from the same place. No, if you don't like that idea, please let me know. I'm always interested, like I say, in feedback, right? So Tovah just asking, is there a connection? B'makom shebal lechuvah, absolutely, that's what that means. I mean, again, b'makom where penitents stand, righteous people cannot reach, right? The bal tshuva. So again, we normally explain, the guy tasted lobster. I don't miss lobster. I don't know what lobster tastes like. So I don't know what I'm missing. But I have people who've told me lobster tastes very good, and they miss it. That's one of the hard things, becoming a bal tshuva. So I don't have that thing. So they're a much higher level than I am. But it's, of course, that's the simple explanation. But the real explanation is sin causes you to be on a higher level because you sin. And Rav Soloveitchik has one of his essays in Al Tshuva, his fantastic book on Tshuva, is about this theme that we know this. We, when our, in our own eyes, walk into shul and look at the Balei Tshuva and look at the I don't like to use the terms, but you know what I mean. Look at the FFBs and look at the Balei Tshuva and look who talks more and look who takes their davening more seriously. It's not 100%, but I think you know what I mean. There are often someone he's for 20 years, he has to make up for lost time. So his meticulousness, his eagerness to do mitzvot, it's because he sinned. And to say what Rav Aaron Soloveitchik said, based on Freud, right? We all know the power to do evil is the desire to do evil is much stronger than the desire to do good, right? If we want to hurt someone because it's raining outside, ain't going to stop us. It's raining. I can't go to shul this morning. I couldn't get wet. It's too cold, you know. And when it's to do something good, there are 5,000 excuses. I'm mad at somebody. Nothing in the world is going to get in my way. So that power for evil is much greater. And therefore, a Baal Tshuva, that's what Rav Soloveitchik explains. If you can take that power, that negative power, and now convert it to positive energy mitzvot, wow, you're going to be on a much higher level than someone who never had sinned. So I don't know, it sounds like, and I guess I sort of have, we better go out and sin so we can do tshuva. But of course, the Rambam writes, we're not allowed to do such a thing. That's one of the things you're not allowed. Echta vashu. But okay, even without planning to sin, we have enough sins that we can do, that we can use it to transfer. I'll just say one thing. I see Ariel has her hand up. I'll get to you in a second. I may mention Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. I remember when he gave he spoke once at YU. So Rav Aaron, the Rav's younger brother, and he said, I may have told the story before. He was reading Freud as a teenager, and he told his mother, if you know anything about the Soloveitchik parents, the mother was extremely, came from a very well-read, liberal type of education, kind of. And the Rav's father came, you know, Rav Moshe, they almost, the sister writes about it. They almost got divorced because the wife would talk about Dostoevsky and Russian literature and all kinds of things. And Rav Moshe couldn't take it. He wanted to talk about it, Rav Chaim and the Tosfos, Rambam, he couldn't take it, and he left. He left the marriage after a few months. I can't stay married to such a person. And he went back to Brisk, I think. And then they convinced him to go back, and she turned him around. And he became, Rav Moshe became, quote unquote, a Torah mother person, whatever term you want to use. She was a Feinstein from the Rav Moshe's first cousin. The Rav's mother and Rav Moshe Feinstein were first cousins. So that's Angie. So Rav Aaron was reading Freud. So he told his mother, I guess, but he was afraid to tell his father. He was afraid to tell his father. And his mother said, no, you have to tell your father. You have to tell your father. So he went to Kivut up, aim. And so he went to tell his father he was reading Freud. He didn't know what his father would do to him. And his father did not get at all upset. Maybe by that time she had really worked on him. I don't know. He wasn't upset. And then he told him a pshat of, the father, Rav Moshe, told him a pshat of Freud, right? How did Shlomo HaMelech know who the right mother was? Right, let's the fighting who the mother is. So no, can't cut the baby in half. So obviously the mother who says don't cut the baby in half. So that's Shlomo HaMelech knows the mother, right? That's what everybody says. So Freud says no, pumfakert. It's the mother who is willing to let the child die. That's the one who isn't the mother. In other words, it's not from the love. It's from the hatred. You'd let the child die. So Freud knew from the opposite. The power of evil is so much stronger than the power of good. So if we can harness that power for evil, for good, that's Balei Tshuva is much greater. So that's why a sin is a precondition to becoming a tzaddik. And when the Gemara talks about there are four people, I forgot to look it up, the Gemara in Shabbos, I think one of them is Yishai, one of them is Achit. I know people like who have no importance really in Jewish history, who never sinned, because you're not going to be great if you don't sin. Okay, I've said that enough. Aviel, did you still have a question or want to ask or not?
Hi, Rabbi. How are you?
Good. Thank you. How are you?
Good. Thank you. So I just have a general question, and forgive me because I am a convert, of course. And, okay. But prior to converting, I and other converts, we have learned that when visiting rabbis to address converting and whatnot, we may face some embarrassments. It's sort of a test to see if you are very serious about this decision of converting and whatnot. So you see where I'm going.
I think so. First of all, we have a strict we have to treat converts nicer than everybody else. There's a mitzvah of after the reich kachamocha. Who do we have to love? So we have to love reicha, which the Gemara says is your your spouse, really. Yes, it also means everybody, but the Gemara interprets Reyacha to be your spouse. You have to love God, you have to bishop, and you have to love converts. You don't have to love your parents. I'm not saying you shouldn't. There's no mitzvah to love your parents, but you have to love converts. And there's a special prohibition not to oppress a convert. I think what you're raising is that intermediate ground. Before we accept the convert, the Gemara says you're supposed to give them a hard time. But I don't think a hard time means embarrassing the person. It's just you want to know if they are committed to converting. And you're, I think, correct me if you're raising that, sometimes by definition, that hard time might be embarrassing. I don't have a good answer to that question. And maybe that would be reason enough not to give someone a hard time. I don't know. That's a very... I thank you for raising that very important point. I think, I know somebody should bring, I've never been involved in a conversion, you know, on a personal level. I mean, I know converts, I don't convert, of course, but I've never, and I've only actually attended one conversion. I had learned with the person for a while he was quote unquote non-Jewish. And, but I, you know, in Toronto, the Beit Din was doing all the conversions, but he asked me to come. I went to the conversion, but I didn't do the conversion. I wasn't, you know, whatever. So I think that's an important point. Yes, you have to be very sensitive. Even if you have to check for sincerity, you can check for sincerity without being too harsh. Okay, I hope that answers a little bit. But yeah, you have to be very careful. That you know, the famous, if I can say, that reminds me with Asara Haruge Malchut. So who were killed first? Rabbi Yishmael and... Rabbi Yishmael Kohen Gadol, I forget, there was a whole, I think he was talking, it's in the Mechilta, I know. I forget who he was talking to and saying, why are we being punished? It's on the Pasuk Imanat Hanef, you oppress an orphan or a widow. So the Mechilta, the Midrash commentary in that verse, quotes the story of these two rabbis were going to be killed by the Romans. He said, what did we do wrong? What did we do wrong? So the one says to the other, you know, did it ever happen that a woman came knocking on your door? Old woman, a widow, somebody, a convert came knocking on your door. And, you know, you were busy, you were eating supper, you were cleaning up, you were finishing a tosfot. Imanatane, if you oppress the convert, that 2 seconds that you make them wait. You know, if I was rich, they would come running to the door. They would answer the phone. But because I'm a nobody, they don't come. So that's what one rabbi said to the other. That's why we're being killed by the Romans, because we treat the rich and the powerful a little bit better, a lot better than we treat the convert and the orphan and the widow. It's hard. Keeping kosher, that's the easy stuff. Shabbos, easy. No, putting on davening every day. So we don't daven with kavana, but it's easy. This stuff is hard. This is something you got to really, really, really work on, you know, being sensitive to others. So you're right. And the rabbis have very high standards of when you cross that line. Gemara wants to know if you're serious, but it doesn't say give him a hard time. Actually, if you look in the Gemara, it's in Yevamos. The Gemara in Yevamos that discusses conversion says, Bali Kayer or something, Nokrisha Bali Kayer, somebody comes to convert. So you tell them, are you an idiot? And in a nice way, you say, don't you know, cruise, Scud missiles, Hezbollah, Hamas, don't you know, people, Hitler, people kill Jews. They get pleasure out of killing Jews. Why? Who needs it for? And he says, and if he says, Afal Pikain, if he says, great, beautiful, I identify with the Jew. They're so caring and sensitive, and they want to make the world a better place. That's why they don't like us. Sinai, Mekavlin Oto Miyad. I believe that's the experience where you immediately accept them. Now that you've accepted him, you start teaching him the mitzvah. By the way, last week when you went to McDonald's on Shabbos afternoon and you drove your car to McDonald's, great. This week, if you drive to McDonald's on Shabbos, then we're going to kill you. Because in theory, there's a death penalty for Shabbos. Yeah, we never put it in, but you don't tell the convert that stuff. You tell him this week when you drive to McDonald's or even to a kosher restaurant, the kosher restaurant's open on Shabbos, whatever. I saw their advertising in New York, a Seder restaurant, $185. I guess, you know, whatever, what expect them to charge for a Seder, you know. Then you tell them, you know, it's really bad, so he can pull out. But it's not that you give them a hard time. You just let them know that people like to kill Jews. I mean, I hate to say it, but that's what the Gemara says. And he says, I want to be, So yes, it is true. You have to be very, very, very sensitive. Okay, let's try. Okay, I hope that helps a little.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay, let me at least get through the first Mishnah. I really thought I would do it. Zeb, I apologize. I really thought I'd get through half of Esa Makoman. I may get through half of the first Mishnah. Okay. Kochim, she can tell me some fun. Okay, so Kochim, we said, are up north, Chatat, Asham, Ola. Very nice. Par v'sa'ir shel Yom HaKippurim. So we start, we're going to go from the holy of holy, the holiest korban, to the least holies of korbanot, the korban pesach. That's how we end. The korban pesach is the least restriction. That's the easy. Everybody brings it, eat it wherever you want, well, almost wherever you want, you know, and whatever, the, you know, so that's going to be the last of the korbanot is going to be the korban pesach. But so par v'seir shel Yom HaKippurim. So what are the par in the seir of Yom HaKippurim? Well, what's the seir? What is this? What's the par of Yom HaKippurim? Okay, Dohan, I'll answer. Okay, so the par is the Kohen has to bring a par. The Kohen has to bring a bull. And on that par, he has to do vidui. The Kohen does vidui, confesses for the sins of the Jewish people. This is in Masechet Yuma. This is all described in not in Zvachim, in Masechet Yuma, in Yom Kippur. So the Kohen brings a par and he does vidui three times. If you remember the Musaf, which we, you know, the Seder of Oda, this is what we do. We recount it. So twice he confesses his sins on the par and once for his family and once for the family of Kohanim. And then the third time he confesses his sins on the seir, but not this seir, a different seir. He confesses sin on a goat, what we call the seir hamishtaleach, that goat that's hurled off the mountain, that goes 10 kilometers in the desert. That's the seir hamishtaleach. And but there's a second seir. The second seir is the seir lashem. Is the seir goes to God. That's the seir we're talking about here. We have to bring from Klal Yisrael, shnei seirim, achad l'chatat, right? One is a korban chatat, a sin offering, and one is gets thrown, right? This gets thrown away off the mountain, this seir, hamishtaleach. And the sixth parak in Masechet Yuma say the two seirim have to be exactly the same, have to be the same height and the same money and look the same, like identical twins. And it's funny, I didn't plan on this. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik gave a tshuva drasha. You know, the Rav got his famous, you know, tshuva drashas he gave every year. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. That's part of the Nela tshuva. But by the time I came to YU, the Rav wasn't well enough to give the drashas anymore. So they had different people. So one year, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, his brother gave it. So Rav Aaron was talking about this Mishnah, how the seirim have to be alike. The two seirim, one that's going to be sacrificed in the Holy of Holies, and the blood is going to be sprinkled three places, a really holy sacrifice. And one is going to get rid of it, our sin. They say they used to tear, they had to build a special ramp to get the seir, because whoever had that seir, people wanted to rip out it. Get out of here with our sin. We don't want it here. They had to run out to get rid of it. So he said they have to be exactly the same. You know why? Because whether one is going to sin or be good is exactly the same. You can't tell at the beginning. You're here. You can go this way or that way. It's exactly the same person, two people, same height, same background, same everything. One is a Seir Lashem and one becomes a Seir Lazazel. It's a beautiful idea, I think also. So the Torah wanted to have two to contrast. It's up to you. It's a lottery. Maybe take a lottery, but it's up to you what you're going to be. So this is the So the par is his par that he does for vidui confessions for the sins of him and for his family. And this Seir Lashem is the Seir that's offered as a Korban. Now, these two Korbanot, they're the Par Seir and Yom Kippur, you slaughter them in the north, then you accept their blood in the north. Basically, just to know, you want to get in your notes, there are four Avodot for every Korban. There are four needed rituals, I don't know what you call them, four avodot, four services that you have to do to make a korban valid. That is shechita, kabbalah, halacha, and zrika. You have to slaughter the animal, obviously, except if it's a korban mincha, then you do, or if it's a bird, you do milika. When it's a bird, you cut it with your fingernail on the back of the neck. You don't slaughter the bird the way we slaughter birds. They slaughter them differently in the temple, milika, but okay, that's not important now. So you have to slaughter the animal. You have to get some of the blood in a vessel, shechita, kabbalah, holacha, and you got to walk and got to throw it on the altar. Those are the four avodot to make a korban. Shechita kshera bizarre. Anybody can shech. You don't have to be a kohen to shech the animal. Anybody can shech the animal. The other three avodot must be done by a kohen, but anybody can shech the animal. So anyway, so they would shech the animal in the northern part of the temple. They would get the blood there, and then they had this sprinkle. Daman ta'un hazaya al habadim. They had to sprinkle the blood three times on the Badim, the Parochet, and Mizbeach Hazav. This is very unusual. So this is the only court. The Badim, what are the Badim? The Badim are the poles. The Aron Kodesh, which didn't exist in the Second Temple already. The Gemara Yoshiyahu, towards the end of the First Temple, was Gones. I guess I did see Raiders of the Lost Ark, but I don't remember it. Right, he was Gones the Ark, deep down below, because he knew the temple would be destroyed. The Netziv has a whole long essay, I forgot, I read one for wild, about how Torah changes and different elements of Torah. But Yoshio hid the Aron. There was no Aron, and that was one of the major differences between the first and the second temple. But when there was an Aron, and others, they had a place symbol they still had the Holy of Holies, they just didn't have the Aron in it in the second temple. So they had the Aron was held by two poles. Rav Shimshon Val Hirsch explains, because Torah is portable, right? Jews often have to run from place to place, but they got to go quickly. So you can't take the furniture, but you can take the Torah. So it was always on poles. The poles were never allowed to come out of the Aron Kodesh. It's always ready. Your suitcase is always packed. And the most important thing in the suitcase is the Sefer Torah. So that was in the Beit HaMikdash. So in between the Badim, in between the poles, that's where you sprinkled the blood. Like, in other words, on the Aron Kodesh, on the Aron Kodesh. Then you got to do it on the Parochet. Remember, one day a year, except if you were a janitor, right? But the janitor can go in more often. He had to clean the place, right? The only time regular people, I say, could go into the Kodesh HaKodeshim was on Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur. So this is the only day of the year. So you go into the Aron, he sprinkles the blood. And then he sprinkles the blood on the curtain between the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKodeshim. There were basically four sections to the Beit HaMikdash, a broad section. Number one was the Ezrat Nashim, what we call the woman's gallery. This is the source of Mechitza is from the Beit HaMikdash, although I don't know if it's exactly the Ezrat Nashim in that context. Ezrat Nashim was the biggest courtyard. Men could be there too, by the way. That's what originally Mechitza was. The woman could be there, men could be there, anybody could be there, but it was sort of... there were people who could enter the Ezrat Nashim when certain levels of Tumah who couldn't go further in. Then you had the Azara, where you had the outside altar where almost every korban was brought. Not these ones, but were brought on the outer altar. That's where you had, we met 32 by 32 Amot. We mentioned last week the size of the altar. Then you had the Kodesh, the holy place. And that's where he mentioned, that's where you had the menorah, the shulchan, where you put the showbread, the table, the menorah, and what am I forgetting? And the Mizbeach HaZahav, and the golden altar where they brought the Ketoret. We spoke about the last week with Ketoret. That was in the Kodesh. Only Kohanim could go in the Kodesh. A non-Kohen was not allowed in the Kodesh. And then the Kodesh Kodshim, you kept going inner. You're going towards your west. You're going like east to west. So the furthest western part of the temple was the Kodesh Kodeshim. It was about, the Kodesh was, I believe, 20 Amot by 20 Amot. Not very big. 30 feet by 30 feet was the whole Kodesh. And 10 of those Amot were, maybe it was 20 by 30, and then 10 of it was taken up by the Kodesh Kodeshim. They were not big areas. The whole Har HaBayit was 500 Amot by 500. The entire area was 700 feet or so, 750 feet by 750 feet. A few football fields. I mean, it's big, but it's not humongous. But this part was much smaller. So the Kohen, they had to sprinkle the blood on the curtain separating the Kodesh and the Kodesh Kodeshim. It was actually machloket, but it was a dual curtain. You had to like walk in the entrance on one was on one end and the entrance the other. So you had to walk the whole length. You know, you understand you have two curtains to get in. So one you have to, if you can see, one you have to enter this way and one you have to enter that way. So they had to walk through and to get to the Kodesh Kodeshim. Anyways, they would sprinkle the blood there. I don't want to spend too much time on the details, just the first time a little. And then And basically, he would do everything first with the par and then with the sir. He would copy. That's what we do on Yom Kippur. Achad, achad, ashtayim, achad, v'shalosh, achad, v'arba, sprinkle one and seven, right? It was really seven. He used one, and then he would count, like one and two, one and three, one and four, one and five, one and seven. We did that three times. That's what we do on Yom Kippur. And one was in the Holy of Holies. One was just outside in the Kodesh, the curtain, entering before you enter the Holy of Holies, and then the third time on the golden altar, on the Mizbeach HaZahav. And then Shayarei HaDam, whatever leftover blood, you would put on Yesod HaMaravi Shel Mizbeach, on the western base, on the outer altar, right? The main altar, that's that base of 32 amot by 32 amot, 48 feet by 48 feet. That's where the outside, they would pour the excess blood there. Okay, that's the first one. I'll just introduce the second one, and we'll go through the rest more quickly, I think. Parim HaNisrafim is Sarim HaNisrafim. The burnt bulls and the burnt goats. You slaughter them in the north. What is that all about? What are the burnt goats? So there's certain korbanot, very few, that you burn them, all of them. You just burn the whole thing. Not on the Mizbeach, not outside the Mizbeach. So you put a little bit, you take a little bit of the fats and you put it on the altar. So I guess the one we'll talk about now, there are only three of them. One is this par of Yom Kippur. Okay, that's this par gets burnt eventually. But the other one, I guess, well, I'll just mention the par halam davar shel tzibur. The par halam davar shel tzibur, it's an amazing korban. It's such a beautiful concept. I don't know how to say it in a nice way. It's the anti-dat Torah concept that the Sanhedrin can make a mistake on an Iser Karet. Wow. The Sanhedrin can say this, so you can worship God like this. Oh, we made a mistake. That's idolatry. Whoa. Or the Sanhedrin could say, you can do this on Shabbos. Ah, we made a mistake. It's Chilul Shabbos. So whenever we have a whole masechet in Shas called Horiot, Horu Beit Din. The Beit Din makes a ruling and it turns out it's wrong. And it turns out it's wrong is the most serious sins. Hilchot Ni, only in Iser Karet. If they do in the most serious of sins, they make a mistake. Quinoa is not chametz. Okay, I know. Right? Oh, it wasn't right. Quinoa? Is that the whole fight? It is kidney. I don't know. Is quinoa kidney? Not kidney. It's not kidney, right? Okay, I'm sorry. But you know what I mean. They say this food, forget kidney, because kidney is obviously allowed on the Torah, but you get the point, I hope. So they made a mistake. This food is not chametz, and it turns out it's chametz, and everybody ate chametz. Or they didn't realize this was milk product, and they thought you could put it in Indian rice. The Beyond Burger had some meat in it. It's not a pure vegetarian burger. And so when you put your cheese on the Beyond Burger to have the taste almost like a cheeseburger, you're eating meat and milk. That's not an Easter Karet, but... No, it's not an Easter Karet. But anyways, whatever, that idea. So the Beit Din makes a mistake. So the halacha is not everybody brings a sacrifice. That's crazy. We just follow what the Beit Din did. So the Beit Din brings a sacrifice on par he'elam davar shel tzibur. He'elam. It escaped their knowledge. They made a mistake. They have to bring a bull. The 71 greatest rabbis and the Jewish people sitting there together debating. It's not like one person made a mistake. They had wrong, whatever it is, they made a mistake. So they have to bring a korban. So that korban gets totally burnt. Paralam davar shel tzibur. Parim goes to mizbeach. So that's the parim hanisrafim. I just pointed out it's a powerful concept. The same way that Moshe Rabbeinu in the Parsha tomorrow, we mentioned it last night, admits he made a mistake. Great, the greatest of people. It ties in a little bit the same way the greatest of people can sin, and maybe you have to sin in order to become great. You have to sin. Great people are going to make mistakes. We're human beings, so I think they go together. Sin and mistake are not exactly the same; they're related. But so that's the par helam davar shel tzibur, which gets burned. Okay, I think we can stop here. I hope I haven't overdone the korbanot stuff, but just let's quickly do a review. So we discussed that why we say Ezim and Koman. There are no debates, but we said there, of course, because in the temple you would expect very few debates, and that's true, although that didn't last. The temple is the place of peace, and we said debates, there's at least one trend of thought in Judaism, all debates are bad. Hillel and Shammai become like two Torah, that's at least an idea like that. And the temple is a place where we want to have the least debates, and therefore the Kohen were very careful. But at a certain point, the temple was corrupted. We know that historically. And people perhaps stopped coming, and therefore the first debate was whether you're allowed to do smicha, to put transfer your symbolic self onto the animal on Yontif, because you're not allowed to use animals on Yontif. I didn't explain what the problem was. You're not allowed to. So can you do that on Yontif for the purpose of a korban? And we discussed that the chatat has to be sacrificed in the same place as the ola. A, not to embarrass people, how important, not to embarrass converts, not to embarrass anybody, but especially converts, widows, orphans, the poor, especially the people who are, it's more difficult for them. You have to be extra special. We don't want to embarrass people. We have to read the Bikurim. You said the rabbi should say, hooray, hooray, at mekudesh ali. Do everything. You spilled the wine, whatever. You make kiddush with a sitter. You don't want to do anything that has a tinge of embarrassment. It's very hard to be really sensitive like this. Don't say kiddush off by heart if there's a guest in your house. Well, who would think like that, you know? So anyways, unless you yourself don't know kiddush by heart. Okay. So, but we said, I thought the even more powerful reason is the only way to get to Ola, to get fully to God, is through sin. That's how we grow. That's how we grow. And everybody sins. And it's through sinning. But Makom Shabali Tshuva, we grow from our sins. We get more intense in our mitzvot. That power for evil, which is greater, gets transferred for good. So therefore, the sin is actually, that's why I didn't say this before. That's why a sin gets turned into a mitzvah. That's what the Gemara says. If you do proper tshuva, certain tshuva is not, the sin is part of the mitzvah. It's because you sin, your mitzvah is done with greater fervor, greater intensity, and greater commitment. So sinning, the chatat has to be where the olah was. And then we started to discuss a little bit about the actual Ezim HaKoma and the service on Yom Kippur, the part of the seer, the bidu that he does, the same, two seerim look the same, be the same, but one turns into the Sir LaShem, one turns into Sir LaZel. We ended by go from sinning to making mistakes to Par HaLam Davar Shel Tzibur. So we read it a couple weeks ago in the Torah, when the Beit Din makes a mistake, that's the first thing we have to admit. Beit Din makes a mistake. The problem, how do you know they make a mistake? Whatever it is, that we won't get into all discussion. The Gemara says, what if you know the Beit Din is wrong? It's a fascinating discussion in the Gemara. The Beit Din issues a ruling, and you know they're wrong. You know they forgot the Beyond Burger has meat in it. But I'm a silly example, but you know what I mean. So, and you know they're wrong. Do you still listen to the Beit Din? So that's a fascinating discussion. We'll leave that for next week, maybe. Not a big discussion, but anyways. Okay, I want to thank you all for coming and your comments.
One last question?
Absolutely, even if it's not a quick question. Now that it's over, you know, you can, yes.
Last thing that you said, that they're not burnt on the Mizbeach.
I'm sorry?
The Parim Nisrafim, you said they're not burnt on the Mizbeach.
No, a little bit is. They take part of the fats and put it on, but the rest of the animal is burnt. Yeah. The only korban that I can think of that, I have to check, but offhand, the only korban I can think of that nothing gets burnt on the Mizbeach is the Korban Pesach. I said the Korban Pesach is the last of the korban, because it's sort of the least holy, so to speak. The least restrictions, you know, it doesn't have all these details. Like
the other parts are burned where? Where are they burned?
No, they burned. So it was not burned in the temple. They burned it in the Beit Hadeshen, which was outside of Yerushalayim, outside the Beit HaMikdash. Yeah, that's coming up. And we didn't get there. Elu ve'elu nisrafim ve'beit hadeshen. That's the end of the second Mishnah. We didn't quite get there. We stopped. We just did the first line of the second Mishnah. But yes, it was burned outside of the temple. Outside of the temple. Okay. Anybody else? Okay.
No, I got a question.
Yes.
Can you expand on this smicha being asur on Yom Tov? Exactly why? Where does the Torah say that?
I don't know. It's a rabbinic prohibition to mishtamesh bebalei chaim. You're not allowed to make use. So I know I don't have a dog. So I don't
you're allowed
know.
To shech that animal on Yom Tov.
Right.
Why
right,
can't you but, touch it?
No. But to shech because it's ochel nefesh. You can eat it, but to go and to play ball with, like to you know, I don't know, I know exactly right where the issue of smicha was somehow considered using balei chaim. I also don't fully get it, but if you look at the Mefarshim, make and look further, they just say is it an iser ishtamshut bebalei chaim, using animals on Shabbos. So how do you define using? I don't exactly know. Eating though is allowed because it's, you know, it's ochel nefesh, but this is not for eating purposes. And that's you know, how important is smicha? Part of the machloket is smicha ma'akid. Do you need smicha? It's just a nice thing to do, or is it really an integral part of the korban? It's not you know. And can you do it beforehand? Can you do the smicha? You can do the smicha beforehand. Take up the smicha, you know, shkita. The Gemara explains. I said for five generations they were arguing. So what was their argument about? So that the Gemara explains a little bit. Okay.
Shabbos. Yes.
Mr. Zucker.
Look, this happened historically that the Sanhedrin of 71 Talmidei Chachamim made a mistake and afterwards.
Did it happen historically? Am I aware of a case in the Gemara?
Yes.
Offhand. That's an interesting question. A case where we know that the Sanhedrin made a mistake. I don't know, but we know there's a Masechet and Shas about it. So it's the last Masechet in this beginning. So the Gemara obviously considered it relevant. I'm sure there were cases they made mistakes. I don't know. That's an interesting, but it's, yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know. I don't know offhand.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Okay. All right, if no more questions, we'll wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom, and please God, we'll see you on Sunday, Rabbi Liebtag at 11:15, and then Monday, Rabbi Kowalski continues his series on Pesach. I think he's talking on Parah this week. I have to double check. And then Zeb Aleph continuing and making Pesach American. Very interesting. Pesach developed historically in America. They went through last week how peanut oil, how it went from being kosher to not kosher, in a period of 30 years, things change. And then, of course, on Wednesday, Ari Mermostein also in his series on the issues on Pesach. Tuesday, Rachel Sharant, Rachel Danziger, and Alex Izzy will be finishing his series on Eliyahu Hanavi. Okay, everybody, Shabbat Shalom. Look forward to
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you very much.
Invite a friend and all the best. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a great Shabbat.
Okay, you too. Great Shabbat. The second of our long Shabbat. First long Shabbat in Israel, now that they changed the clock last night. So, Tova, you get, an extra hour to sleep in the afternoon?
With all the kids running around, I
hired... No sleep. That's no sleep. That's it. That's good. Grandmother's
parents,
supposed to
let
sleep.
Let the parents sleep. The grandparents can work.
That's it. Yeah. Okay. Shabbat Shalom. Bye-bye.